Well, good afternoon. We are now proceeding to the afternoon session of this workshop. Thanks again for attending the whole day. It's a long day, but we are covering interesting topics. The first presenter of the afternoon session is Professor Ruth Gruber, who is a professor of psychology at McGill University. Her expertise among various things is sleep deprivation and its consequences for our health and daytime functioning. And the title of her presentation today is Sleep Behavior and Obesity. Ruth, I will turn this to the screen.
Well, thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. As a sleep researcher, I know that you must be pretty tired now. It's kind of your nap time, and you just had something to eat. So I'll try to keep you alert and awake with my talk about sleep and childhood obesity. And what I'll try to do is first to describe the association that has been found now robustly between sleep and obesity, and then to try to describe some of the mechanisms that might underlie the interplay between sleep and obesity. And then I'll try to offer some practical implications. So once we know that this might be the case, what it is that we might be able to do about it. How many of you, I know that people here do obesity research mostly, how many of you have heard of this connection between sleep and obesity? So all of you. Okay, so I'll just skip it very quickly because sometimes people are completely not aware of it. So I'll try to bring something new, but I might not be able to. So we do know that in over the past, I would say 40, 50 years, we've seen parallel trends where we've seen an increasing body mass index, we've seen increase in the prevalence of hypertension and diabetes, and at the same time, we've seen a decline in the average sleep duration, and this applies to everybody, to children as much as to adults. We also, we have witnessed an increase of childhood obesity. Currently, we know that 37% of the children who are between the age range of 6 to 11 are defined as overweight and obese. And we also know that in the past 6 years, there has been a significant increase in the prevalence of obesity amongst children. And again, parallel to this trend, we have seen significant decrease of sleep, specifically in children and adolescents. In a recent poll that was conducted by the National Sleep Foundation, they found that roughly half of the adolescents are sleep deprived, which probably does not surprise you if you know adolescents. And what might be more surprising is that it starts very early. Even elementary school kids have been found to report of feeling tired during the day, and the numbers are stunning, like 40% of elementary school kids are already tired even before they've reached the pubertal stage that we think that prone them to be more tired. And when we look at it from a global perspective, this is how it looks like. We see this mirror image of sleeping hours decreasing over time and obesity rates increasing. So this leads us to the question as to, are these things related to each other, or it just happens to happen in parallel? And what we know now, again, from population-based studies, from epidemiological studies, from cross-sectional studies, from longitudinal studies, that this association between short sleep duration and increased risk for obesity or increased BMI is a very robust finding. And it's not just a coincidence, it's not an artifact, and it's been found in studies that have controlled for many potential confounders that could have explained this interplay between sleep and obesity. And these are some studies that have been done in children, and you can see that it goes from a very young age, and you know, it goes all the way up towards adolescence and adulthood. And these are studies that focus specifically on children. And we can see here that even sleeping less at an early age, like during infancy, is a risk factor for having a higher BMI or being at a risk for obesity in an older age, but not very old. You know, when the children are as old as 3 years of age, we will already see this increase in the risk, their risk to be obese or to have high BMIs. And on the reverse side, it's also been shown that, and this will be the last study here, it's been shown that additional hour of sleep when children are very young, between the ages of 3 to 7, was associated with lower risk for obesity. So it does go both ways. This being said, the natural question is why? Why do we see this type of link between sleep and obesity? What are the underlying mechanisms? And we know that obesity is being caused by so many factors, and the question will be why and where does sleep fit into this complex picture? Before I'll try to describe some of the mechanisms, I want to just give a very brief intro to sleep regulation, and it will be 6 seconds about sleep. So obviously it's not going to cover the complexity of sleep, but just for the sake of making this link, we know that there are two main processes that regulate our sleep. One is the homeostatic sleep process, which basically determines how much sleep we're going to get. And the other one is the circadian sleep process. It's our biological clock, and it determines when we're going to get this sleep. I can sleep 8 hours, but it could be during the night, and it could be during the day. Ideally, if I want to be able to function, I want to get my 8 hours during the day. Most of the research about obesity has looked at homeostatic processes or mechanisms related to and the relation to processes that could be related to obesity. And this is what I'm going to focus on in this talk, but I did want to mention the circadian sleep system as well as some mechanisms that regulate our arousal system, because between being awake and the timing of us falling asleep, we also need to be able to regulate our arousal, and arousal and sleep are opposite to each other. And there are some underlying cellular mechanisms that regulate being awake and being asleep. And what I would just mention, although I don't have time to get more in depth into it, is that these processes that are regulating sleep and eating are interrelated even at the cellular level. So for the sake of the presentation today, I'm going to focus on the homeostatic process and how it might be linked to processes that are contributing to the development of obesity, but I do want us to keep in mind that there is more to this story than what we can cover right now. So in terms of homeostatic sleep process and the risk for obesity, sleep deprivation, not getting enough sleep, has been associated with all of these processes: energy homeostasis and appetite regulation, glucose homeostasis, the stress response, fatigue and its impact on physical activity, and our food choices or food preferences. It's been shown and it's been found in experimental studies that when we deprive people of their sleep, there was an experiment that people frequently cite that was done by Eva Van Kouter, where she asked healthy individuals to sleep either 4 hours or 7 hours, and she simply looked at how it affected their metabolism. And what she found that was later on replicated in other studies was that that sleep deprivation has this type of impact on our metabolism. What it does, it decreases leptin, it increases ghrelin, it increases the subjective feeling of hunger, it increases our appetite, and specifically appetite for high-caloric food, and as well as appetite for other foods. So just by not sleeping enough, we get to this mechanism in which we carve more rich food, and our metabolism changes in the direction of wanting more food and feeling less food. And all we need to do to get there is just not to sleep enough. It's as straightforward as that. And one night will be enough to start affecting, seeing this change in metabolism. What we also know is that short sleep duration increases the risk for insulin resistance. And what has been shown is that sleep loss or sleep deprivation is associated with increased levels of cortisol, hypertension, so it will eventually could lead to insulin resistance. But it also been shown that it is directly linked to insulin resistance in obese children. So again, it's another mechanism by which not having enough sleep is going to contribute to the development of obesity. It's also been shown that, and I think that some of us might have experienced it, that when we're tired, somehow we're going to crave sweet food. I don't know if we think about it in a more physiological way or psychological way, but we're searching for something that will help us to stay awake. And it's something that I've heard from many, many individuals, and I'm sure that, you know, some of you at least have experienced it. And it's been shown also empirically that when we're tired, when we're sleep deprived, this is what we're going to crave. It's going to increase our craving for sweets, for starch, and for salty snacks. And it also changes our food-seeking behavior in the sense that we want to snack more, to have more food when we're snacking, but not necessarily, it's not necessarily going to get us to simply have a bigger, better meal. It's going to really change our eating patterns in a way that is consistent with increased obesity. Again, we have all been there. When we're tired, it's really hard for us to make the decision to go and be physically active, either going to the gym or just being active as opposed to simply engaging in more sedentary behaviors. And this has been found in one of the more recent polls that were done by the National Sleep Foundation. When they looked at adolescents, they found that 32% reported that they were too tired to exercise. When they were asked why they were not going to do more physical activity, they simply indicated that they were too tired. And this is very consistent with the findings that show that roughly half of the adolescents are sleep deprived. So it makes sense that it goes together. And obviously, when we're tired and we're not sleeping, we might engage more in watching TV and doing some of the sedentary behaviors, again, that have been shown to increase obesity. And another, again, pretty obvious fact is the fact that when we're not sleeping and we're tired, we just have more time to eat. And this is what we're going to do. We're going to eat, watch TV, not move. And obviously, it can go together with increasing our risk to gain weight. Now, there is some other mechanism that could be related to sleep deprivation. And I don't know that they have been validated empirically, but we are actually working on some of these, on exploring some of these potential mechanisms. We know that one of the things that will be directly and very quickly affected by sleep deprivation is our ability, our executive functions, our ability to self-regulate both cognitively and emotionally, our ability to control our behavior, our ability to regulate our mood. And what could also be a mechanism that somehow links sleep deprivation to overeating will be the simple fact that when we're tired, our ability to self-control and to self-regulate decreases immediately. It affects the prefrontal cortex, which is the brain area that is most sensitive to the impact of sleep deprivation, and this could be another mechanism by which being tired leads us to consume more food, not just because we crave more sweet food, but also because we are lacking our potential baseline ability to simply stay away from it and control ourselves. So this could be one mechanism. And the other mechanism, again, that is very much related to the consequences of sleep deprivation is the impact of sleep deprivation on mood. It really affects our mood in a negative way. And again, you don't need to be an expert to know it. If you did not have enough sleep, you wake up in the morning, many of us are not going to be the usual nice people that we might be otherwise. And every little thing will irritate us, and the more that we're tired, the more irritated we're going to become. And this is what happens to everybody. It happens to children, and this sometimes is related to overeating too. So these are more speculations. We do work on making these speculations into more empirical science. We do look into these mechanisms, but I don't have data to share with you at this point. So I'll just do it very quickly here. Given the time that is running out. But I was trying to link it all together so we can show that we can say that sleep restriction could be related to alteration in our metabolic profile as well as could affect our ability to regulate our appetite, which would eventually lead to changes in our eating behaviors, both in terms of the quantities, in terms of the types of the food that we might want to consume, and in terms of the timing of food. And again, we don't have much time to talk about it, but you can think about how when you eat is going to affect how much you're going to sleep, and vice versa. The circadian system is also part of this complex picture, except that we don't have time to get into it. And all this together is going to increase our energy intake. Being sleep-deprived is also going to make us more tired, which is going to affect our self-regulation, mood, self-control. which again is going to contribute to potential changes in our eating behaviors that is going to end up leading to increased energy intake. And, of course, being tired is going to reduce our physical activity and increase our sedentary behavior, which will lead to reduced energy expenditure, which will altogether combine to lead to increased BMI. So in terms of mechanisms and the homeostatic sleep process, this is what we know the most. As I mentioned before, there might be more to this interplay that is more at the cellular level. And one potential mechanism is the orexin that is related to both the regulation of metabolism as well as to the regulation of sleep and wakefulness. And this is a whole domain of investigation. There was a recent talk here given by Denis Borkov, and this is what he studies. And I think that some people here might be looking at it as well. And I'm mentioning it just in order to say that it might be something that is really way more basic and way more at the fundamental processes of the way that we function than just this complex behavioral environmental diagram that I've just presented. So this being said, we know that sleep could be related to the increased levels of obesity. Is there anything that we can do about it? How can we perhaps prevent sleep deprivation? We don't know much about how the timing of eating is going to affect our levels of obesity, but we do know that not getting enough of it is going to have an impact. So is there a way for us to try to change it? And we know that changing behavior is always a big challenge. Changing eating habits is a challenge. Changing sleeping habits is a challenge. But it doesn't mean that we should not try to do it. And what we do know is that fixing sleep sometimes improves some of these processes. It's been shown that treatment with melatonin decreases blood pressure. It's been shown that treatment of obstructive sleep apnea leads to improvement in insulin resistance and hypertension. And we have found that sleep extension improves cognitive processes. So there is a reason to think or to hope that by reversing the trend of this epidemic of sleep deprivation, we might be able to do something to also oppose this trend of increasing obesity rates. And one way of doing it, and of course it's not the only way or the ultimate way, but it is what we have started to do here in Montreal, is to try to educate children about the importance of sleep, trying to provide them, just like we do in many schools now across the world, I would think, education for trying to get them to be more physically active and to teach them the basics of healthy eatings. What we try to do is also to throw into the mix education about the importance of sleep and how to engage in better sleeping, hoping to decrease the prevalence of sleep deprivation. So the program that we developed, we called it Sleep for Success. And what it's based on principles of participatory research, which means that we created it with the teachers, with the children, with the parents with whom we work. And we developed the material using an evidence-based approach, which means that we tried what we have eventually included in the program to see that it actually works. And it has four modules, and this kind of reflects, I think, what Lloyd might have started with in the morning, talking about the fact that in order to prevent an epidemic, it's not enough to target the kids, it's not enough to target one individual, we have to target the environment of the child, and this is what we were trying to do with this program. We tried to, yes, approach the children and make sleep knowledge available to these kids, but at the same time, we really wanted to also have the family and the community on board. We wanted the school principals on board, we wanted the teachers on board, and the program basically covers all of these target audiences. We also were not ignoring the fact that sleep is not the only thing, so we were trying to integrate it with other healthy lifestyle factors like physical activity and obesity. And we created a program where it's all very child-friendly. This is our sleep squad, which we use to teach the kids about sleep. And I think that if I have 2 minutes, do I have 2 minutes? I'll just show you a short clip.
It's already on.
So I just need to press play?
No, yes.
Mm-hmm. And I needed to...
It's already...
It's working?
Mm-hmm.
So
Students in Brossard are getting a wake-up call.
Sleep for Success is a special program at the school that teaches kids about the importance of getting enough shut-eye.
It seems children in Quebec aren't getting enough of it, and the risks are serious. As Camille Ross reports, a few simple changes can help.
So you can go to the first page.
Class may be on, but many of these students are feeling pretty off.
Really tired, because I went to bed late.
What were you doing?
Watching TV.
And I was up late until 11 o'clock.
Sleepy students are becoming a problem. Researchers at the Douglas Mental Health Institute hope to put the issue to bed before it gets any worse. They've designed a sleep awareness program and plan to make it part of the school curriculum in Quebec and beyond.
Making small modifications to bedtime, changing a little bit their sleep environment, changing what they call sleep hygiene, which is the behaviors that will promote good sleep.
Through special comic books and activities, students learn about the consequences of going to bed too late. Mrs. Grunefeld says the problem is getting worse.
There are students who chronically come in late that are running behind everybody because they have trouble getting up and getting organized.
Researchers say TV distracts children instead of calming them down.
Usually I watch TV and then once my show is over, that's like a signal for me to go to bed.
Usually around like 9:30, watching TV in my room.
Sleep deprivation can do a lot more than just impact a student's performance in class. It can also have a negative impact on their overall well-being.
Sleep deprivation has been shown to increase obesity rates. It's been shown to lead to metabolic diseases, to cardiovascular diseases.
To stay healthy, children should get about 10 hours of sleep. Parents are warned to avoid schedules that are too full.
Make sure that you keep your child's bedtime as a priority when you plan your general activities.
My secret of going to sleep, I usually read a bit because that calms me down, so I'm not as excited when I go to bed.
Try, tested, and true. Helpful advice that could help revive sleepy students. Camille Ross, CTV News, Montreal.
Canadian astronaut Bob Thirst paid a
visit.
This
is not part of it. So just to wrap up, what I've shown here is just one effort, and what we hope to do as part of the Brain to Society mission is actually to try to integrate what we have done, you know, with regard to the pediatric sleep intervention, to integrate more into obesity prevention programs, and to get more in-depth understanding of the underlying mechanisms so that we can redefine more specific targets beyond just sleep duration in this effort to integrate sleep into the research and the prevention of childhood obesity. Thank you very much.
We have time for a couple of questions.
There's another aspect that comes to mind hearing your talk, which was excellent, which is that, of course, teenagers have this tendency to sleep a little bit more, to sleep later in the morning. And then they're rushed to get to school in the morning, they're probably not eating properly. Can you talk maybe about that aspect as well?
Thank you. This is the part of the talk that I wanted to give, so it'll give me an opportunity. Yes, absolutely. I think that, you know, what we know, first of all, in terms of what we know about adolescents, we do know that, you know, they tend to skip breakfast. There is a phenomenon that is called breakfast skipping, right, and it's been shown to lead to, again, contribute to the risk for obesity. And one cannot ignore the fact that one reason, amongst many other reasons, that this might happen is because they are rushed to go to school in the morning, they're tired, they're sleep deprived, and we don't know how skipping food is going to affect our sleep, that in turn is going to affect our eating behavior. What has been shown in animal studies is that you can actually reverse sleeping patterns by changing meal times. And there is a very nice study where it's called Staying Awake for Dinner. I cannot remember the name of the investigator, unfortunately. But what they've shown is that in animals, this is what you do. You can really affect the sleep system by changing meal time, and you can affect consumption of food by
changing sleeping time. So I think that looking more at the circadian system and how mechanisms that are related to both sleep and eating is one next step that is obvious. We do know that food is a time giver, right, is a Zeitgeber. For people who don't do sleep research, the way that the circadian system works is that we time our sleep based on cues from the external universe. So one cue is the light and darkness. But the other cue that people don't talk about much is actually food. So I think that there is way more to this interplay between food and sleep in adolescence, but also in general, that we don't know about. And I do hope that we will start looking more into how these two things are interrelated at the behavioral level, but also in terms of the underlying mechanism that affect how much we want to eat. And again, when we're going to be sleeping, I think that it's all interrelated. Thank you.
Your comment on the efficacy of melatonin and the risks, or would you use it with high school or college students?
Yeah. Well, usually melatonin is not approved by the FDA, so you know it's not a formal hypnotic or sleep medication. This being said, we do know that people do use melatonin, and we don't know about significant side effects. So I cannot make a formal recommendation to use it, but we do know that it works. The key is to know what's the purpose of using melatonin. You can use it as the chronobiotic to change the timing of sleep, and you can use it as hypnotic to help somebody to fall asleep. And the dose will be very different between these two purposes, so it really depends on what it is that you try to do. A problem with melatonin is that because it's not regulated, when people go and buy it at the drugstore, they don't really know what they're getting. So sometimes you can buy melatonin and you don't really know what it is that you have there, which will be another reason to be very careful when and if somebody might use melatonin. So we do know that it works. We don't know about safety enough because it's not been studied enough, and we do know that it's not approved by FDA. This is what I can say.
Other questions? I have one question. One of the children...
Oh, yes, I had a question. I was wondering, just two actually.
Yeah.
From the homeostatic point of view, if you're supposed to have 10 hours sleep, but for whatever reason it's just broken up into 5 hours, 5 hours, or 8 hours, 2 hours, in a 24-hour span, does that make up for it, or would that be actually adequate enough sleep amount of time to break all these...
Well, it's a tough question. I don't know that we think that you... There are two parts to it. I think that, yes, you can compensate for lost sleep. I mean, we see it all the time, you know. What we think that happens with adolescents is that they're sleep deprived during the week and then they have a catch-up sleep on the weekend. If it's good or bad and if it serves the same purpose, even if it's going to prevent the consequences of sleep deprivation, I'm not sure that we know the answer. You can compensate in terms of your homeostatic need, but is it going to then prevent or undo the potential damage that sleep deprivation has done when you were sleep deprived? I don't think that we know.
And then the second question was, and I guess it's more circadian, but let's say you have shift workers,
right,
who work overnight and then they're asleep during the day. Is there a way to minimize, like, should you be telling them to sleep as much as they can through that day to have amount of homeostatic sleep? Or there are some who actually do some days and then switch over to nights after a couple of weeks and then they just keep on shifting back and forth.
Well, I don't know that I would know the answer of how to make it healthy for people to do shift works. I think that you can probably decrease their suffering by helping them to develop ways to at least accumulate the sleep that they need in order to not suffer completely, but we do know that it has major consequences in terms of their health. It's been shown to increase the risk for cancer. It's increasing the risk for cardiovascular diseases. So I'm hoping that we don't have too many nurses here that are going to feel very bad about, you know, their shift work. But you can minimize the pain in a way, but I don't know that you can prevent necessarily the long-term consequence of working against your circadian clock. I mean, it might be, but I just don't know how to do it.
If you can follow up on that before you go, we'll come to that. Speaking of the shift workers, are there any studies in, say, for instance, flight attendants? It's a natural experiment if you go overnight bus drivers. The second thing I noticed, one of the kids said that they feel excited before they go to work. So how does all these new sort of social networking tools come into play, Facebook, etc.? Because I think there's a lot of literature that's sort of growing that people spend a lot of time feeling connected. We're all social creatures. We want to be connected, but sometimes
It's just a very good point. I mean, in terms of social networking and all the social media, we know that this is one of the main barriers to sleep in general, in particular to adolescent sleep. I collaborate with Dr. Noper on a study where we're specifically looking at these kind of behaviors in adolescents, and we know that we're going to find it. The challenge is how can you somehow not prevent but decrease it, given that it's so addictive. I mean, we all know that computers are addictive, we know that social media is addictive, and we know that social life is so important to adolescents. So what we're trying to do, which might not be successful eventually, is to find potential motivational factors to somehow deal with it. But it's a real problem. It's been shown in many studies now, and this is a major barrier to get enough sleep. And I think that it's beyond adolescence, but it's been emphasized in adolescence. And you had another part of the question, I'm sorry.
Oh, about any sort of prevalence studies among sort of flight attendants?
Right. I'm not familiar with too many studies, but we do know that, you know, there are many recent accidents that have been caused by fatigue, either flight attendants or people who are supposed to communicate with them. So I think that sleep deprivation is a real issue, and, you know, there is a real risk that goes with it. It's been studied more, I think, in the context of car accidents, and we know that it's a key risk factor, and we know that fatigue actually increases the risk for car accidents even more than alcohol, except that we know how to monitor alcohol, but we cannot stop drivers and send them to bed, you know, because they're too tired. But it's a real problem. I mean, we can do it for blood, you know, alcohol levels. We cannot monitor fatigue level, which would be at least as dangerous as alcohol.
I think there's one last question.
Yeah.
I noticed that your sleep program frames it as a choice about how much people sleep. I think it's a choice when you go to bed, but you don't actually get to choose how many hours your body will take.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a difference there between...
Yeah. Absolutely. I think that you're absolutely right. We know that there is no one sleep duration that is going to be good for everybody, and we know that we have different systems and different bodies. But what we can control is when we go to bed. So if usually what limits our ability to get enough sleep is the fact that we have to wake up at a certain time in the morning and go to school and go to work. So the only thing that we can do to help ourselves to get enough sleep is to make sure that at least we have enough opportunity to be sleeping. And then if you have trouble falling asleep, obviously this is not going to help you. You'll need extra help to learn how to fall asleep, which is something that we can do. So the purpose of this program is, one, and mostly to increase the priority that families and children give to sleep on their schedules, on their agenda, to take into consideration sleep needs as much as they take everything else, and then to make sure that the child gets an opportunity to get whatever amount of sleep that the child might be needing. Yeah, we have people who are more morning types, and these people, again, it depends on their sleep needs, and it depends if it's an insomnia or they're just, you know, this is their nature. And it will be insomnia depending on whether they need to sleep more but they cannot go back to sleep, versus people who simply are morning types, and then they will wake up early and they will be able to start their day. As long as they can go to bed at a time that allows them to sleep according to their needs, they should be okay. I think that the key is not, you know, there is no absolute number that I can say that we all have to sleep during the night. It's more to be attuned to your sleep needs and then to respect them and to make sure that you have scheduled time that allows you to get enough sleep.
So should it be actually healthy night things? It sounds like the night is sort of coming first.
I don't know that we can really distinguish. I mean, what we eat during the day probably is going to also affect us and vice versa. So we chose, you know, this perception of... I think that the whole brain to society approach is, you know, it's not to dissect, but it's really to see how things are interrelated to each other, which is partly, you know, the inspiration to this.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, everybody.